Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Collins Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. In the late morning on February 14th, just a few weeks ago, a radiological event, a radiation leak, occurred at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP, 26 miles southeast of Carlsbad, New Mexico, when airborne radioactive particles were detected as having leaked within the underground facility. In the wake of the leak, the newly confirmed Secretary of the New Mexico Environment Department, Ryan Flynn, noted, quote, "Events like this should never occur. From the state's perspective, one event is far too many," unquote. Joining me today to discuss the recent radiation leak at WIP are Russell Hardy, the director of the Carlsbad Environmental Monitoring and Research Center, known as CMERC, an entity of New Mexico State University, who joined us by phone from the center, and Don Hancock, director of the Nuclear Waste Safety Program at the nonprofit Southwest Research and Information Center here in Albuquerque, who joins us in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. I do want to mention for listeners, the people that we invited who were either unable to come or didn't give us a reason for coming. We didn't invite a representative from the New Mexico Environment Department. We were told that Secretary Flynn, who wants to take the lead on this with the media, would be on an airplane at the time of the show. We did invite someone from the Department of Energy. We got finally yesterday a statement, "We must regret," was the quote. We did ask someone from the Carlsbad office, the field office manager, the president of the company contracting to run WIP, Nuclear Waste Partnership. We renewed our request for Farouk Sharif with that company yesterday and never did hear a response. So not to downgrade the people who are with us, thanks so much, Russell and Don, but we did invite people from public agencies, public employees, and they are not appearing with us today. So back in the early and mid-90s, before the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant opened, there was great opposition to the plant among some communities and people. And perhaps everyone in New Mexico knew about WIP then, maybe not so much now. In fact, Don Hancock, you and I became acquainted with one another when I was the executive director of the Santa Fe-based nonprofit Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety for a few years in the mid-90s, and I'm no longer affiliated with that group. So for the benefit of those who do not know much about WIP, let's do some really quick catch-up about the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant. So Don Hancock, who runs WIP?
So the Federal Department of Energy is the operator of WIP, and the co-operator is a company that you mentioned. It's called Nuclear Waste Partnership. It's actually a consortium of URS, B&W, which is Babcock & Wilcox, and Areva, the French-owned company. So they operate this facility.
But essentially, it's a Department of Energy facility.
Correct. It's a federal government facility. The land, the 16 square miles that make up the WIP site, is by Congress and under the law is under the control of the Department of Energy.
Now, I know we could get really detailed about this next question, but what is being shipped to and stored at WIP, and how is the storage occurring?
So WIP is for defense transuranic waste. Transuranic is plutonium-contaminated waste from producing nuclear bombs. So it's not nuclear bombs, but it's the residues, materials that come from making it. So it's plutonium-contaminated. It's come to WIP over the last almost 15 years. The first shipment was in March of 1999. So it's come from about a dozen sites around the country, as far away as Hanford in the northwest, Hanford, Washington, and Idaho, and as far in the southeast as the Savannah River site in South Carolina, and from also Argonne in Illinois and other places. So over these last almost 15 years, there have been almost 12,000 shipments by truck to WIP, about 170,000 containers, totaling a little more than 90,000 cubic meters of waste.
Now, how is the storage occurring there? There's some geological formation?
So WIP is it can be conceived of as a salt mine. It's in salt, about 2,150 feet below the surface. The concept of salt is, the rationale for salt is, it's relatively easy to mine, and over time the salt will creep back in to close up the void spaces. So the idea is you mine out the salt, you put these containers of nuclear waste in it, and over time the salt will seal it back up and contain the waste for essentially forever.
Now, Russell Hardy, what role does the Carlsbad Environmental Monitoring and Research Center, or CMERC, play with regard to WIP?
So we were established in 1991 through a financial assistance grant from the Department of Energy to basically serve as an independent environmental monitor of the WIP site for the citizens of Southeast New Mexico and Carlsbad. And so we do environmental testing of the air within the repository, the air outside the repository. We do soil testing around the facility. We do drinking water samples from the municipal water systems in the area, and surface water and sediment collections from the three lakes that are nearby the WIP facility. And then we also have a whole body counter where we open it up to the public for people to come in to get lung and whole body scans to make sure that what's put in the waste isolation pilot plant stays in the waste isolation pilot plant.
Now, you said you monitor within the repository. Does WIP have its own monitoring system as well?
Yes. There are three groups that basically perform the same function, albeit we have, you know, our different samplers, but we're basically doing the same thing. So CMERC, my entity, you have the WIP contractor that does their own environmental monitoring, and then the New Mexico Environmental Department.
And those, so it's like a monitoring in triplicate, the same type of monitoring?
Correct.
Okay. Now, when I was sort of getting ready for the show, I looked at sort of four time periods with WIP that we can look to, and, you know, we'll generalize quite a bit here, but what happened before the February 14th leak? What happened during the February 14th leak? What has happened subsequent to the February 14th leak, and what will happen with WIP in the future? So, Don Hancock, tell us, walk us through what occurred at WIP in the late morning on February 14th, 2014, and Russell Hardy, if you can certainly add to these if or dispute any of these facts.
So, it was actually not the late morning, it was late night.
Late night.
The Department of Energy reported that about 11:30 at night,
p.m.
Okay. on February 14th, in other words, shortly before midnight, the underground continuous air monitoring at WIP tripped, and what that does is it triggers that there's there's radiation detected in the underground, and it also makes the ventilation air flow through a filter system, a high-energy particulate HEPA filter system, so rather than just venting the air and outside into the environment, it goes through the filtering system. So at the time, there were no workers underground. There were 13 workers on the surface of the site at this time, 11:30. And so the question was from the beginning, well, what happened and did anything leak out?
And Russell Hardy, these basic facts, is there any dispute about those at all?
No. We have to go by what the Department of Energy has said, and based on their time frame, approximately midnight is when the event occurred.
Now, what role did CMERC play in detecting or confirming this leak, if any?
So I was notified of the leak approximately 2:30 on Saturday afternoon and began to discuss with my team, you know, what our role would be. At that point, we knew that the employees at the WIP site were sheltered in place, so we have sampling stations on site, but we knew we wouldn't be allowed access, rightfully so, and we didn't want to go at that point to get our samples. So we focused our sampling on our two off-site air sampling locations. One is a half mile roughly northwest of the facility, and the other one is 12 miles southeast. Now, these are ambient air samplers that are about 15 feet off the ground. So Sunday morning, about 7:30, 8 o'clock, a technician and I went out and retrieved filters from those two off-site locations. We brought them back, and you know, your listeners have to understand that this is not CSI as seen on TV. You can't put a sample into a computer and an hour later spit out a printout. These are very laborious, detailed processes that it takes, if everything goes right, from 3 to 5 days to go from a filter to a set of results. So we retrieved our first filters on the morning of the 16th, roughly a day and a half after the event occurred, and we published our first results on the 19th. And those results showed, and this is total activity per sample, this is not taking into account time or flow rates, but about 0.64 becquerels, which is a disintegration per second of americium-241, and 0.046 disintegrations per second of plutonium-239 or 240 on the sampler located nearest the facility.
Now, these are particulates that were released into the air?
Right. So these are radioactive particles, atoms, basically, that found their way to our sampler and got trapped on the filter media.
And now, none of us in this conversation is a doctor, but are these safe limits to be within our air that we're breathing?
Well, there's plutonium and americium in the air that we breathe all the time. And this is from, you know, previous weapons testing, previous bombs, detonations, previous nuclear incidents. So, you know, if you put these into perspective of what's out there already, it's probably no greater risk. What is important is that we can tie these back to the WIP facility and we can prove that, you know, something did get out, albeit very small, a minor amount.
Don, you want to add something?
So it's important to understand these americium and plutonium that Russell's talking about are dangerous, highly toxic to human health for very long periods of time. Plutonium-239 has a half-life of more than 24,000 years, which means half of the radioactivity today will still be there 24,000 years from now. So the reason to put it 2,150 feet underground is to make sure that none of it leaks out in the short run or in the long run. So this event, as Kathleen, you quoted at the beginning of the program, the Secretary of the Environment said, even one event is too many. We've been assured, the public's been assured by the Department of Energy and its contractor that there would not be any leak for 10,000 years, and we're 15 years into it, and we've had a leak.
So this is a big, big deal then. I mean, I don't mean to make light of it, but I, you know, I see the materials that say start clean, stay clean, and the fact that really it was not supposed to leak any radiation for 10,000 years. So let's to whom is this leak of concern with regard to exposure then?
Well, the first people of concern, of course, were those 13 people that were on site that night, Valentine's Day night, all of whom subsequently, after the time frame that we've talked about, on February 26th, in other words, almost 12 days after the event, the 13 workers were notified that they tested positive for internal radiological contamination. So it's a special concern for those 13 workers. Department of Energy announced yesterday that their second round of urine samples from those 13 workers came out negative, so that's a good thing. But so there are 13 workers that were contaminated.
They were the only people on site during that time?
There were 13 people on site, and every single one of them tested positively for internal radiation. So that's a concern. The second concern is those people went to their homes. And so while the Department of Energy said at the time there was no contamination that they detected, obviously that was wrong. And so it is possible, we don't know this, but I think there should be checking on people's homes and et cetera. People left the site. Then a third thing that happened that I think is frankly pretty unconscionable, on Saturday morning, the normal Saturday workforce showed up at WIP, had no protective clothing or anything, because the Department of Energy thought, and Nuclear Waste Partnership, the operator, thought there hadn't been any leak from the site, when in fact there had been. And so some number, DOE hasn't said exactly how many, but more than 100 workers apparently came to the site on Saturday morning Several dozen of them, again, DOE hasn't said an exact number, but several dozen of those people are now having bioassay urine and fecal analysis done to see if they also have contamination. And the results of the on those workers have not come back yet.
And one of the we submitted a list of questions to NMED, the Environment Department. We submitted them the same questions to the Department of Energy. We submitted the same questions to Nuclear Waste Partnership. We have not received answers to those. They are pointing us toward a town hall and a press conference that will be held in Carlsbad this evening. But one of the questions we asked was, how many other workers have been tested? How many other workers have been asked to be tested? We're talking today about the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP, and a recent release of radioactive particles from the facility. We're joined by Russell Hardy. He's the director of the Carlsbad Environmental Monitoring and Research Center. And also we're joined by Don Hancock, director of Nuclear Waste Safety Program at the nonprofit Southwest Research and Information Center. If you would like to join in our discussion, there are several ways for you to participate. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call In Show webpage at kunm.org. You may call our local number, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. Tell us, do you have any concerns about the continued operation or expansion of the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP? We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll return with our guests and with callers and with comments.
Remember last spring when you had three chances to win beautiful prizes donated by the Santa Fe International Folk Art Market and a brand new scooter donated by Lobo Scooter? Who says you never get a second chance? Check your mail and send back your entry by April 4th for three more chances to win. If you didn't get a mailing, you can register, donate, and see our brand new 2014 thank you gifts, including some really fun KUNM temporary tattoos at KUNM.org. Click on the scooter.
Radio Ambulante presents stories from Latin America. You don't always hear these voices on public radio.
Cuando vives en un país extranjero, los amigos son tu
culturales más impactantes de la historia de la Argentina.
Well, now you can. I'm Martina Castro, co-founder and senior producer of Radio Ambulante. Today, we present our first show in English.
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
So we're back with the KUNM Call-In Show, and we're talking today about the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP, and a recent release of radioactive particles from the facility. I'm joined by Russell Hardy, the director of the Carlsbad Environmental Monitoring and Research Center, and also Don Hancock, director of the Nuclear Waste Safety Program at the nonprofit Southwest Research and Information Center. We did invite representatives from the New Mexico Environment Department, from the Department of Energy, from Nuclear Waste Partnership, the primary group run the WIP site, and none of them are appearing with us today. But we have our two wonderful guests here to answer questions and comments. And I want to go ahead and just return. We did have a Twitter comment, and this caught my ear too, Russell. The statement that plutonium is always in the air, and certainly when I was director of Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety, we'd always hear information about particulates are always in the air, or you're only getting as much exposure as you would with an X-ray or from the sun. So let's go ahead and revisit that topic just briefly. Plutonium particulates or particles are always in the air, Russell?
Right. So we have plutonium in the environment, like I said, from weapons testings that began back in 1945 and continued through the 1980s. Now, to put that into perspective, the highest amount of plutonium that we have ever detected from one of our ambient samplers out in this area is 0.004 becquerels, or disintegrations per second.
And the recent was 0.64, did I hear you say?
0.64, okay. Immediately after. Now, Don raised some good points, and I think they're valid points, but let me try to put this into context for you. So the Sunday morning that my technician and I went out to gather these samples, we were a little bit apprehensive because not much had been known about what had been released or what the magnitude of the release might have been. So we took some safety precautions. We took a handheld instrument. We took some live radiation monitors so that we could, you know, make sure that we're safe while gathering these samples. And so we took this first filter off of the near-field sampler, which is 0.6 miles northwest of the facility. And we took that handheld instrument and we counted the activity on that filter right as we took it off. And so this handheld instrument measured about 500 counts per minute. Now, that's a gross count. That tells you the total activity of everything that's on that filter at that time, which can include radon, uranium, polonium, thorium, whatever is in the soil or in the environment that happened to get on that filter, plus what we were looking for, which is what might have gotten out of the WIP facility. So to take that 500 counts per minute and get it to a disintegration per second, which is the way we report our data, you have to divide that counts per minute by the efficiency of the detector. And so these handheld detectors are usually between 20 and 30% efficient. So 500 divided by 20% is the same thing as multiplying by 5. So it's 2,500 disintegrations per minute. And then you divide that by 60 to get disintegrations per second. So from a gross activity point of view, this filter measured at that time that we removed it about 41.67 disintegrations per second, or 41 becquerels. When we brought it back to the lab, digested the filter in acid, separated out the various isotopes, extracted all the different activities, and threw away everything except what we were looking for, the americium and plutonium, which is what's included in the waste at WIP, what we were left with was 0.64 becquerels of americium and 0.046 becquerels of plutonium. So let me just put this into dollar terms. So when we did the gross scan, we had activity of $41.67. When we threw away everything that's natural, everything that's out there already, and boiled down to exactly what additional was put on this filter, we've got 64 cents worth of americium and 4.5 cents worth of plutonium.
All right, let's let Don comment briefly.
So the point is, none of the americium and the plutonium that Russell detected, and remember, it's not just at that one point. In fact, we don't know how much plutonium and americium is out in the environment because of this release. But none of that is supposed to be out in the environment. The reason we've spent $6 billion of taxpayer money on the WIP site is to try to ensure that none of this gets out. The other issue is, I appreciate Russell's work, and I particularly appreciate the fact that CMRC has been publishing their data. So these numbers that he's mentioning are available in written form so people can look at them on their website, et cetera. That's a good thing. The Department of Energy isn't doing that yet. That's a problem. But the point in terms of health effects, it's not me, it's not Russell, it's not Jose Franco, the DOE manager, it's not Farouk Sharif, the general manager of Nuclear Waste Partnership, that are medical doctors with training in treating people with internal radiation contamination. And I frankly object to the Department of Energy putting out press releases saying no health risk when they're not the medical doctors that have the training and experience in this, haven't examined from a medical standpoint the workers, haven't done all the testing that they might think is necessary. And so I don't think we can conclude anything yet other than that people are contaminated. What the health effects are going to be, no one knows.
Well, we've got full phone lines. I'd like to go to the phones. And callers, I'm going to ask you to keep your comments and questions brief if you can, so we can move through our calls here. Our first caller up is Glenn from Jemez Springs. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this very pertinent discussion. First of all, I think Don Hancock needs to get a Nobel Peace Prize for all of the work he has done for 20-some years, being a watchdog for all of us citizens. I went down into WIP in 1997 with a group of students from around the country. when I was a chaperone, and I was concerned at that point. I was of the understanding that there's an aquifer below the site, another one above it. Is not anybody concerned about our water and what could happen to all of this radiation in the aquifers? All of the radiation that New Mexicans have suffered from the Trinity site, from downstream, from Los Alamos, the Pueblo, the folks around Gallup with uranium, hasn't New Mexico had enough radiation? Nevada had this huge mountain where they could have stored, but citizens there rose up, said no. I plead with New Mexicans to stand up and say no to WIP. It's had enough problems already, serious problems. They're being hidden, as I can tell. The truth is not out there. I used to drive trucks, and I would see these big trucks all over the place. And when I went into Santa Rosa at the fuel station there, a truck is sitting there, nobody in it. I encourage all drivers in New Mexico to stay as far away from those trucks when they're on the highway. So those are my comments, concern, and please say no to WIP.
All right.
Thank you.
Glenn, thanks so much for your call. And Russell, one of the questions we did submit had to do with any concern about contamination of the aquifers. Can you address that briefly, please?
Well, so, you know, I guess I'm confused about the caller's last comment. The WIP site is in the middle of the Salado Formation, which is a very thick salt layer, and so salt is pretty much impervious to water. In fact, the science has shown that there hasn't been water in this formation for hundreds of millions of years, so
what about,
that's why it was chosen.
Well, what about radioactive particles moving through the salt to the water? Is that not possible either?
Well, the salt is a good insulator, if you will. It's going to, as Don said, the idea is it will creep over and it will encapsulate and it will seal off the waste. Now, you know, obviously this is a blemish on a 15-year safety record, and they're going to have to come up with a way to mitigate it and prevent it from happening again. But, no, I don't believe at this point that there's any concern on the water. We are just now collecting soil samples and surface water and sediment samples. Our primary focus to this point has been on the air because that's the main pathway that these radionuclides can get out.
All right. Let's go to our next caller. It's John from Albuquerque. John, you're an attorney who litigated something regarding WIP?
Yes, I worked on the case for 10 years on behalf of Citizens for Alternatives to Radioactive Dumping. And, of course, Don Hancock was always helping with that case and providing information because he's pretty much given his life to this oversight of this project. And just with regards to the last comment about the Salgado, the formation, I remember this was quite a while ago now, 10 or 15 years ago. We had geologists on behalf of CARD, as it's called, Citizens for Alternatives to Radioactive Dumping, who disagreed with the findings of the government geologists regarding the possibility of escape through those geologic formations. And they presented evidence that there had been water passing through those formations in recent geologic history. So it's just like the very fundamental premise that we discussed in court, which is how do you make something and guarantee that it's going to be safe for 10 years? 10,000 years. I think that's the first question that we asked, and that even the federal judge, originally it was Judge Conway, had a real problem with that. And I think, as Mr. Hancock just noted, here we are 15 years into the project, and that 10,000-year goal seems like a fantasy. And then it sheds suspicion and doubt on all of these other assertions that the government made to get this into place, regarding the geology and regarding the safety of the workers and all of these other issues that have been discussed today.
Well, John, thank you for calling today, and we appreciate your call. And Don, you want to comment about the sort of the public trust aspect of things?
The Department of Energy has not encouraged trust by their response to this incident. As I say, they've reported in writing on several occasions, there was no contamination. Workers were not contaminated. Facilities and equipment were not contaminated. That's wrong. They said that the workers weren't contaminated. And as I said, they let more workers come on site on Saturday morning, February 15th. They were wrong about that. Last night in their press release, when they talked about no health risk to the workers because the second tests of these 13 workers had come back negative, their urine samples came back negative, they included in their press release for the first time a statement that the, and this is a quote, the ongoing air and environmental monitoring around the WIP site, both by our contractor and by independent parties, is showing no significant off-site contamination. Or in other words, there is some slight off-site contamination. Up to now, the Department of Energy has denied that there is any contamination off-site. So what they need to do, what DOE needs to do, is stop making these conclusory statements that there's no risk, there's no contamination, nothing's been detected, and instead put out the data that they have in terms of what levels of contamination they're finding at what locations, so that people can judge for themselves what's significant or not significant.
Well, and you're having to parse words. What does it mean? Significant, insignificant, off-site?
But
I mean, that's a problem. You shouldn't have to, is what I'm saying.
You shouldn't, but they shouldn't bury in the end of a press release their first-time statement that they have found off-site contamination. They've been saying for 3 weeks since the incident that there is no off-site contamination, and now they're essentially saying that there is some slight amount of off-site contamination. It's frankly likely that that is the case. As Dr. Hardy has said, they've detected radionuclides 0.6 of a mile. The winds have blown since that time. These particles can move around, and so, you know, contamination can continue to spread, just as Dr. Hardy's new data that he released yesterday on the filtration system and the exhaust shaft shows that, yes, it's very small amounts, but there is continuing releases, there's continuing radioactivity in the underground that can come out even through the filter system. These are small amounts, but there's additional radioactivity that appears to be coming out of the WIP site.
And Russell Hardy, please go ahead and comment on this and what you take it to mean that there's off-site contamination.
Well, so, you know, as I've said all along, our organization is early in our analysis. It's probably going to be a year or more before we close the book on this chapter. But, you know, as Don pointed out, the numbers that we released yesterday, which were from the day of the event through the 21st, so only a week's time period, shows that there still is activity in the repository and small amounts getting through the HEPA filters. Now, the HEPA filter are designed to contain 99.97%, so it's not 100%, but I think it is doing its job taking out a bulk. But there is a small amount that is showing up in our filter samples after the HEPA filtration. Now, again, it's unfortunate that we don't have real-time data, because it does. If you do a gross scan, you're not going to see it. You have to go through the full process of 3 to 5 days to separate out and count the actual actinides in order to get a quantitative measure of what is there. So, you know, unfortunately, we're looking at data right now that is of last week instead of this week, so I can't tell you today what's actually coming out.
Let's go ahead and take our next caller. She's been on hold for quite some time. It's Sasha. I assume it's a she. I apologize if not. Sasha from Santa Fe. You'd like to comment on citizen input.
Thank you. Good morning. I just wanted to say it feels like the 1980s all over again, because here we are fighting WIP again. We have been conditioned to think of it as a done deal and there's nothing we can do about it because the repository was open, and until now the operational safety record was pretty darn good down there. And I do think the people who work at WIP take their training seriously and take their job seriously and do an amazingly good job considering what they're doing. But this leak demonstrates to us that there's only so far that hubris can take you in the world of dealing with these extremely hazardous materials. And I'd also just like to point out that the operational safety of the facility while it's receiving and emplacing waste is one thing, and the long-term performance of the repository is quite another. And we have been seeing agitation from several parties in the southeastern part of the state to try to receive high-level wastes that could mean spent fuel rods, or it could mean liquid radioactive waste from Hanford, Washington, that the facility was not designed to take. They have a tendency to view all these activities as economic development down there, which I think blinds them to the longer-term responsibilities to the environment and the people of the future. And high-level waste is much more hot thermally and radioactively. The stuff that WIPP was designed to take, the plutonium, is the stuff that basically lasts forever. So if you have higher temperatures generated by the hot, high-level waste that they want to bring in, drawing water to the site, because, and that is what Dr. Hardy did not mention, is that in salt, higher temperatures attract water. And so that breaks down the whole composition of the salt beds that are supposed to be sealing in the waste. And if we put the high-level waste in there, it's going to blast escape pathways out so that the stuff that lasts basically forever can get out quicker and sooner and in more directions. And that would be just criminally stupid and a real it's like a war on the future if you do that. That's just the wrong approach, and citizen input cannot just be from the people who get jobs and get shiny new trucks every year from working at WIPP. It has to be from all of us who care about what happens in the future and whether this area will be habitable. We cannot afford to have our groundwater polluted with these long-lasting radioactive elements when the aquifer feeds into the Pecos River, which goes to the Rio Grande and the Gulf of Mexico. This is a serious environmental concern. It is no surprise that DOE is constantly trying to downplay every single time they make a mistake. It's what they've done all over the country, everywhere they've set up shop, Rocky Flats, the list goes on and on.
All right. Well, Sasha, let's go ahead.
I just want to say we need to keep ourselves focused on not just what happens right now while the facility is open and receiving waste, but also what this tells us about potential problems in the long-term functioning of that repository, which probably will not be able to contain its waste.
All right, Sasha, thanks so much for your call. I really appreciate it. And let's go to Russell first, Russell, because Sasha mentioned high-level waste making inroads in the salt formation. Would you like to comment briefly on that?
Well, I think that there have been talks about getting higher levels of waste within the WIPP facility or a WIPP-like facility in a salt bed. The thing that you have to realize is that spent fuel rods or vitrified, liquefied waste is not an airborne hazard. And so while it may generate more heat, and the waste isolation pilot plant was in the process of doing these high heat studies to see how heat reacts with the salt and whether water is a transport issue within the salt, that remains to be seen. But what we're dealing with right now is an airborne hazard. Those higher level fuel rods or whatever are not an airborne hazard. They're mostly just a heat and a wait for time to decay type issue.
All right, let's let Don comment briefly before we have to go to our next break.
So it's important for people to understand the law, and Congress has reiterated it several times over the last 35 years, prevents any high-level waste, any commercial waste of any kind at WIPP. That's also in the state's permit. So that's both the law and the promises that we've been made. One of the concerns that I've had for a number of years, and now we've had these symptoms of the problem with the radiation leak, is the Department of Energy and Nuclear Waste Partnership, the contractors, have taken their eye off the ball. The ball is the mission of WIPP is to start clean, stay clean, to be safe. There are, Sasha mentioned some of them, but there are five different Department of Energy environmental impact statements that are on the street as we speak about various ways of expanding WIPP. So that's taken time, effort, and taxpayer money, including WIPP people's attention away. The heater tests that Russell talked about, again, There's 30 years of settled science in most independent geologists every place in the world except some people in New Mexico and some people in Germany that salt is the wrong medium for this high heat waste. So the fact that we're spending money and attention in at WIP to try to show something that we already know, heat in salt is a bad thing. Again, so the point of all that is I think that's contributed to the declining safety culture at WIP that's resulted in things like this release.
All right. We're talking today about the recent radiation leak at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP, near Carlsbad, New Mexico. I'm joined by Don Hancock of the Southwest Research and Information Center and Russell Hardy from CMERC, the Carlsbad Environmental Monitoring and Research Center. I apologize. Doesn't roll off the tongue so quickly. We are not joined today by people who we did invite from the New Mexico Environment Department, from the Department of Energy, from Nuclear Waste Partnership, the primary contractor running the WIP site. If you would like to join in our discussion, you may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may call our local number 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number 1-877-899-5866 with questions and comments. We'll be back after this short break.
Saturday night, March 8th at Popejoy Hall, the stars come out with the New Mexico Philharmonic. Internationally renowned cellist Lynn Harrell plays Tchaikovsky's Variations on a Rococo theme. And the New York Philharmonic's assistant conductor Joshua Weilerstein leads the New Mexico Phil in Mendelssohn's signature Italian symphony. Lynn Harrell and the New Mexico Philharmonic, 6 p.m. Saturday the 8th at Popejoy Hall. Info at nmphil.org. A message from the tax-exempt New Mexico Philharmonic.
This week in This American Life, there was this weird story about a year ago. You may have seen this. A guy who was vaguely linked to the Boston Marathon bombings was shot in Florida by the FBI. He was an unarmed man, shot seven times in his own living room by federal agents. Then the FBI started doing a bunch of things that did not make the news. What really happened? Why were they even in that room with that guy? A reporter spent 5 months looking into it. What she learned this week.
Sunday afternoons at 4 on KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and we're talking about the recent radiation leak at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP, near Carlsbad, New Mexico. We did have an email question from Katie in Albuquerque. She asks, who funds the oversight of WIP? Federal? State government? Is the DOE chronically understaffed like many other state and federal agencies? Don, you want to address that briefly?
Well, Russell can talk about his funding, but yes, generally speaking, and I agree with the idea, the Department of Energy should pay for independent people to do monitoring. So the Department of Energy does pay for its own monitoring. It pays for the Environment Department and CMERC's work. Unfortunately, though, as I mentioned, they're also spending money on doing things like doing heater tests in the underground. The issue of funding WIP, as I say, is a $6 billion facility up to now. Congress typically gives WIP more money than what the President and DOE asked for. So from my standpoint, it is not underfunded.
Isn't there a Department of Energy Oversight Bureau within our own Environment Department?
Yes, the Environment Department has a DOE Oversight Bureau funded by the federal government to have oversight at WIP, Sandia, and Los Alamos, the three Department of Energy nuclear facilities in the state.
Okay, Russell Hardy, what have subsequent measurements of radioactive particles at or near the WIP site revealed about the leak, if anything? Is there a thought that the leak is plugged or stopped?
Well, what we've seen is the activity has dropped off. Until they get underground and determine what happened, why it happened, and make plans to contain it and decontaminate from the event, I think we're going to continue to see small levels of radioisotopes being emitted. What is troubling at this point is we don't know exactly what it was. Was it a chunk of salt that somehow either caused a barrel to burp out radioactive dust, or did it get breached? We just don't know. So until they get under and find that out, We really can't answer that question.
And when is there a plan in place for when workers might be able to go underground safely?
As of yesterday, the president of the Nuclear Waste Partnership said that they do have a team. They've brought in experts from Savannah River, from Hanford, from other waste sites that are used to dealing with higher activities, and that they are submitting a plan to have it approved by all the parties, and that it may occur as early as sometime next week.
Well, and Don, until people get underground, we can only just have theories or suppositions about what happened. Is that correct?
Yes, we don't know. And again, there are, unfortunately, we've talked a lot about what we know or think we know. I have a long list of questions that we don't know, and some of which we may never know, even when they're underground, and depending on what they find, it probably will be unknowable exactly how much was released. And we may or may not know the why once they get underground. So it's very concerning that there's a lot that we don't know, yet there are conclusions being drawn, and I think it's too early to draw these conclusions. That's why we need data so that we understand better what is out there and what the risks may be.
Well, if we don't know why, do we know how it escaped? Just essentially, how did it get into the environment?
Well, the continuous air monitor that was triggered at about 11:30 on Valentine's night was outside of panel 7. So that's the newest panel that's just in late January started receiving contact handled waste. So from the presumed point of the release, room 7 of panel 7, to the continuous air monitor, then through the underground salt to the exhaust shaft where it would have come out from the ventilation system, is around 3,000 feet. So you have 3,000 feet of the underground salt that presumably is contaminated. Then the radioactivity went up the exhaust shaft, 2,150 feet. Then it traveled at least 0.6 miles to the monitoring site that Russell mentioned that he sampled on Sunday, February 16th, and has done so subsequently to that. So that, if when you add all those things up, that's over 1.5 miles that some of this radioactivity has traveled. If it's also now off-site, as it appears that it is, then it's traveled 2 or 3 more miles. So we know whatever happened, there was a lot of force to have this radioactivity traveling as far as it has.
And Russell Hardy, do radioactive particles want to travel by nature? Do they want to settle? Is there concern that going underground and into the contaminated area will cause a further release of radioactive particles?
Well, what we know is that even though these are atoms, that plutonium is a heavier atom, so it will fall out. And this has been well documented over many years, that plutonium tends to fall into the ground. It settles into the soil, and it will stay there until something disturbs it, whether it's a high wind or runoff from rain or discharge or some kind of construction or man-made activity that turns up the dirt. The americium is a little bit lighter, so it will likely go a little further. But eventually it will all settle out, and then it will stay there until something disturbs it again.
Well, have we heard from the Department of Energy a plan for going into the site but not disturbing and stirring up the plutonium? Have we heard anything about that?
They have received over 100 soil samples. I don't know what the outcome of those are. As I mentioned, CMRC is just now, you know, we've been focusing on the air transport. Now that we know that the levels are dropping off, we're focusing our attention on soil and on surface water. We don't expect to find anything in the surface water, and then we will continue to analyze the soil around the WIP facility until we see no signature of this event.
Don, you want to comment?
So one of the important points, Russell's emphasized the sort of relatively small amounts of what's outside and the effectiveness of the filters. So that means there is a lot more contamination that's in the underground. And it's not just a matter of workers going underground to see what happened. If that radiation is not cleaned up, workers going underground at the WIP site to handle waste in the future will be consistently exposed to radioactive contamination in ways that they're not supposed to be exposed. So this is potentially a very long-term problem, and it's not only just a matter of how you go in the underground without stirring it up, it's what do you do about having 3,000 feet or more of walls, ceilings, sides of a salt mine that are contaminated with radioactivity. I've asked the Department of Energy what experts they're bringing in to consult with them on decontaminating a radiologically contaminated salt mine. It's a serious question, but in one sense it's a facetious question because the answer is no one has done this. And so the next phase of what to do about the contamination, we're in totally uncharted arenas for not only WIP, but any place in the world.
Before we go to our next caller, I do want to mention we did receive information from the Environment Department, and it was concerning something that we haven't mentioned. I just will mention briefly above ground storage of waste already shipped to WIP that has not been able to be put underground, and the various regulations surrounding that, and the fact that LANL is retaining some of its own waste, the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and it cannot stay there either under state regulations. Just want to mention that. Let's go ahead and bring in Roberto. He's from Albuquerque. Good morning, Roberto.
Good morning. I'm a shaman. I'm a hairdresser, trichologist. I've seen it's like, first I want to say thank you guys for the show, because I've been talking to some clients this year, because I've seen it's like epidemic, clients coming in with hair just coming out, and it's not up, you know, this is something that's like I've seen, and then I've noticed people like from Artesia coming in, bringing their children to some tingly hospital here. I'm seeing a lot, and they're bringing the children to for me to do shaman things. I'm going, no, this is something going on, and you've seen people dying of cancer. You know, what's happening with us is that we have no more mankind. All we have is man. The kind is gone. There's a cover-up going on here. I've seen, you know, I was on the task force with Mayor Martin Chavez for the terrorist task, and the things I learned, the things I saw. And I'm listening to these guys, and I'm seeing what's going on, and I see what's going on with the people in Artesia, and I'm seeing, and they're seeing the sisters dying, they're seeing this people dying. It's epidemic. You see the water in Santa Fe. You see what's going, what we're doing to this earth.
Well, Roberto, I apologize. We're going to have to cut you off because we need to wrap up our show. Well, let me go. Thank you so much. There is a takeaway here, Don and Russell. It's that people are concerned, people are afraid, people are potentially not getting enough information. But we do thank you both for being here so much today and providing information for our listeners. Don, a very brief wrap up.
I would encourage people to continue to ask questions, to contact the New Mexico Environment Department. Contact your federal officials. This is a federal facility. They should be saying what's going to be done to fix this problem.
And Russell, just a few seconds wrap up from you.
Well, like I said, we're going to continue to investigate, and we will report what we find, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent.
Well, thank you so much for your work. Thanks to our guest, Don Hancock of the Southwest Research and Information Center, Russell Hardy of the Carlsbad Environmental Monitoring Research Center for making themselves available to our listeners. Thanks to our callers for helping to develop our discussion today. Apologies to anyone we were unable to speak with. Thanks to our engineer, Jefferson White, our assistant producer, Andy Lyman, who has also handled our phones today. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This has been the KUNM Collins Show on KUNM, news and music that connect from the University of New Mexico.